Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are firing up the time machine and the teleporter at the same time, really.
Right. We're going to two places at once.
We are traveling in both time and space to a setting that I think most of us would find, well, let's just say bracing.
Bracing is certainly one word for it.
Yeah.
Frozen might be another.
We're heading to the Arctic Circle, but we're also jumping back about 50 years to the early to mid 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
We have a fascinating stack of source material here. It's a compilation of memoirs and anecdotes titled Memories and Miracles. And specifically, we're looking at a section called Anywhere and Everywhere.
It is a really compelling collection. And I think it's important to clarify the mission of this deep dive right off the bat.
Yeah, good idea.
While the source material comes from Mormon missionaries, specifically those serving in the Finland-Helsinki mission between 1972 and 1976, we aren't here to debate theology today.
No.
We aren't here to break down doctrine or, you know, analyze religious texts.
Right. We are here for the human experience. We want to understand what it was actually like for these young men. And when I say young men, I mean mostly 19-year-olds, largely from the American West.
Right. Utah, Arizona, Idaho.
Exactly. They are being plucked from the desert and dropped into a post-war frozen landscape that was completely alien to them.
It is the ultimate fish out of water story.
Totally.
You have the culture shock. You have the physical struggle for survival in these extreme Arctic conditions. And then there's this profound historical context of a Finland that was still, you know, deeply scarred by World War II.
Exactly. When you read these accounts, you realize this wasn't just guys in suits knocking on doors.
No.
I mean, it was that, but it was also sleeping on wooden benches in train stations, dodging vicious German shepherds, and wearing these strange plastic holsters under their coats just to survive the wind.
Which is a detail I absolutely love and cannot wait to unpack.
Oh, we will get there, I promise. But let's start with the setting. The sources describe a reality that is honestly much grittier than the clean-cut image most of us probably have.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's far removed from the polished name tags and sort of organized meetings we might imagine today.
Mm.
One of the primary voices in our source material is Earl J. Price. He gives us this breakdown of what he calls the rustic reality of daily life. And frankly, rustic is. That's putting it very politely.
It's a euphemism for rough.
Very rough.
Ish.
He describes being transferred to a city called Sinayoki. Now, you have to imagine you're 19, you're in a foreign country, you don't speak the language well, and you miss your train connection.
Of course.
He winds up having to sleep on a hard bench in a train station, kind of sandwiched between two inebriated locals who are passing out on either side of him.
Wow. That sets the tone right there. You aren't in a protected bubble.
No.
You are right in the thick of it. When he finally gets to his apartment, it's not exactly the Ritz, is it?
Far from it. Price describes the apartment as austere. We're talking about a bottom floor bedroom with a hot plate, but no refrigerator.
Okay.
But the real kicker for me, the detail that really brings home how different life was the water situation.
Oh, the bucket run.
The bucket run. You have to understand, these apartments often didn't have running water in the actual living quarters. So the first duty of every single morning wasn't prayer or study or breakfast.
It was grabbing a bucket.
It was grabbing a bucket.
Just a simple bucket.
A bucket. You'd have to walk upstairs to a communal sink, which might be shared with the host family or other tenants, fill it up, and haul it back down the stairs.
Wow.
And that was your water for the day. That was what you used for washing your face, brushing your teeth, maybe cooking your oatmeal.
It really changes your relationship with resources, you know, when you have to physically carry every single drop you use.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
And that leads to the inevitable logistical question. If there's no running water in the room and you're hauling buckets just to brush your teeth,
how are they showering?
Exactly. How do you shower?
Yeah.
Well, the short answer is often they weren't.
Right.
At least not daily. Price admits that the lack of showers made things, in his words, a little smelly.
I can imagine.
They relied on a weekly rhythm that was very specific to the culture.
The sauna.
Exactly.
Uh-uh.
Saturday night was the backyard sauna. And maybe, if they were lucky, on a Wednesday they'd get invited to a church member's home to use a real shower.
So twice a week, maybe?
Maybe. But for the most part, they were washing out of a bucket or waiting for Saturday.
But the sauna wasn't a spa experience, was it? I feel like when we say sauna now, we think of like a gym or a hotel.
No. This was the traditional Finnish experience. This was a wood-fired sauna in a shed in the backyard with no electricity.
Okay.
The shower consisted of dipping a bucket into a tub of water that had been heated by the fire and just dumping it over each other's heads.
So it's very primitive.
Primitive, effective, and sometimes dangerous.
Dangerous. How so?
Well, there's one anecdote about a missionary named Willie Monson. He had been doing the full finish routine, you know, sitting in the steam until he couldn't take it anymore.
And then you run outside and roll in the snow, right?
Yes, then running outside to roll in a snowdrift.
Which sounds like a heart attack waiting to happen, but apparently that's the custom.
It is. But the danger came when he came back inside. He's dripping wet, probably shivering, and he slips on the wet floor.
Oh.
He crashes right into the hot sauna stove.
Oh, ouch. That makes me wince just hearing it.
Yeah, he burned his shoulder and arm quite badly. And this is where the language barrier turns a painful situation into a helpless one.
Mm.
Price mentions scrambling to find his Finnish English dictionary just to look up the word for burn.
Oh my God.
So he could explain what happened to their landlady.
That is such a vivid image of being young and unprepared. You're hurt, you're naked, you're in a foreign country, and you're frantically flipping through a dictionary just to communicate, I'm hurt. And speaking of the landladies, or emmente, as they called them, the bathroom situation sounds like another cultural navigation test.
It was. They often shared a single toilet with the host family, and the plumbing wasn't modern like we're used to. Price talks about these toilets with high tanks mounted on the wall and pole chains.
Right, I've seen those.
And you had to have a specific touch to get them to flush.
Like safe cracking.
Exactly. He admits he had awkwardly asked the landlady to come in and pull the chain for him more than once because he just couldn't get it to work.
That is humbling. Nothing destroys your sense of authority like having to ask your landlady to flush the toilet for you.
Not at all.
So you're dealing with the cold, the plumbing, the hygiene. What about food? I imagine 19-year-old boys need a lot of calories, especially in that kind of cold.
They do.
Yeah.
And the diet described in these memoirs was incredibly repetitive.
I bet.
Breakfast was almost universally oatmeal, fruit, and yogurt. One missionary, Daryl Dudley, mentions he hated the yogurt at first. It was this sour, plain yogurt. But eventually, he learned to love it.
It just becomes fuel, right?
It became just fuel. You ate it because you needed to move.
But there was a shift in the dinner routine, right? This is where a specific leader comes into the story, President Wade.
Yes, President Wade. He's a central figure in these memoirs, a very pragmatic leader. He realized that the missionaries were wasting too much time traveling back to their apartments to cook lunch or dinner.
And they were probably terrible cooks, too.
And frankly, they were terrible cooks.
I can imagine. 19-year-olds with a hot plate.
Exactly. Some were eating just a can of peas for dinner to save money for other things.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't healthy, and it wasn't efficient. So Wade instituted a policy. Stop cooking dinner. Eat out.
Which sounds great, but where do you eat out in 1970s rural Finland on a missionary budget?
You go to the Bari.
The bar.
Spelled B-A-A-R-I. But yes, essentially a bar. These were places that served beer and alcohol, sure, but they were also the community hubs that served cheap, hearty food.
Right. I can see how that might cause some cognitive dissonance for young Mormon missionaries who don't drink alcohol.
It caused a bit of social friction at first. You have these clean-cut, religious young men in suits sitting next to locals who might be drinking heavily or chain-smoking.
A little awkward.
But it became their cafeteria. It was the only place to get a hot meal they could afford.
So what was on the menu? What does a dollar buy you in a Finnish bar in 1974?
The staple was panupivi.
Okay, what's that?
Think of a meatloaf patty or a hamburger steak, usually topped with a fried egg and served with pickled beets. It cost about 4 Finnish marks, which was roughly $1 US at the time.
A dollar for meatloaf and eggs? You can see why they did it.
Absolutely. And Gary Walquist, another one of our sources, points out that it actually helped their integration.
How so?
Well, they stopped being these mysterious figures hiding in their apartments eating oatmeal. They became regulars. They sat where the locals sat.
Uh-huh.
The locals got used to them, and they got used to the locals. It, you know, demystified them a bit.
I love that. It's practical diplomacy through meatloaf. It grounds them in the community in a way that just knocking on a door never could.
Totally.
Before we move out into the cold, I want to touch on the travel aspect. There's a mention of the milk train.
That's from Mike Bosley's arrival story.
Mm-hmm.
He took the blue diesel train, which they call the milk train because it literally stopped at every single station.
Oh, wow.
And probably places that weren't even stations to pick up milk cans from farmers.
It really emphasizes how rural the country still was. This wasn't a high-speed commuter line.
No, this was agricultural infrastructure.
Mm.
Bosley also captures that disorientation of the nightless night in the summer.
Oh, right, the midnight sun.
He woke up on the train, saw the sun was blazing, and panicked. He packed his bags, rushed to the vestibule, thinking he had overslept, and sat there for an hour wondering why no one else was awake.
Because it was probably 3-4 a.m.
Exactly. The sun just doesn't go down. It messes with your circadian rhythm, your sense of time, everything. Mm. But while the summer sun is disorienting, I think the real antagonist in this story is the winter.
Okay.
We are talking about the Arctic.
We are, and the sources don't gloss over this. They are very specific about the temperature. We aren't talking about a chilly breeze here.
No.
Yeah.
We are talking about regular days of minus 22 degrees Fahrenheit. That's minus 30 Celsius.
Okay, that's cold.
And it would drop as low as minus 49 Fahrenheit. That's minus 45 Celsius.
Minus 49. I can't even process that. This exposed skin freezes in seconds territory.
Mark Meadows describes it as a shock to the system. He talks about the sensation of walking through your own frozen breath.
What does that feel like?
It hangs in the air like a fog. He said it was like walking through a cloud you just created. And remember, they aren't driving heated cars.
No.
They are on bicycles. They are riding bikes in this.
Which brings us to the holsters. You teased this in the intro. What in the world is a Book of Mormon holster? Because I'm picturing an old Western shootout, but with scripture.
That's not far off visually. This is one of my favorite details because it's so practical yet so bizarre.
Okay.
Gary Walquist explains that they had these custom-made contraptions. It was a dual holster set made of green plastic fabric that they wore like a harness under their suit coats.
Like a detective wearing shoulder holsters for a gun.
Exactly. But instead of guns, each side held a finished Book of Mormon. The primary purpose was transport. They could carry two books without needing a bag, keeping their hands free for the bike.
Makes sense.
But Walquist points out the secondary utility. They were windbreakers.
Windbreakers? How?
Yes. The plastic was impermeable and the books were thick. So if the wind was cutting through your coat, which it does at minus 30, you could turn your body sideways to the wind.
Oh, I see.
The book and the plastic holster would effectively shield your torso and your vital organs from the freezing air.
That is genius. It's makeshift armor against the cold. But I can see how that would lead to misunderstanding.
Massive misunderstanding.
If you're walking around with a harness under your jacket.
Walquist tells a story about being in a public restroom. He had his jacket off or open to adjust something, and a local walked in.
Mm-hmm.
The guy saw this harness with bulky objects tucked under the arms. His eyes went wide, and he bolted.
They thought he was packing heat.
They absolutely did. And you have to remember the political context. This is the Cold War. Mm. Finland is right next to the Soviet Union.
Right.
And here are these young American men moving in pairs, wearing suits, speaking the language, with mysterious bulges under their jackets.
Of course they're spies. What else could they be?
It fed into a persistent rumor in Finland at the time that the Mormon missionaries were actually CIA agents.
That makes perfect sense. If you don't know what they're doing, CIA is the most logical explanation for their behavior.
It's a perfect storm for a conspiracy theory, but the reality was much less James Bond and much more try not to die on a bicycle.
Right. Let's talk about the bikes. Riding a bike on ice is hard enough.
Hmm.
Doing it in a suit, carrying books, in the dark.
And without helmets.
Wow.
On a single gear standard bike.
On cobblestones.
On cobblestones. It was a recipe for disaster. D. Child shares a story that he calls a miracle.
Uh-oh.
He was riding along, literally reading a lesson booklet, while steering with one hand.
Oh, that's a terrible idea.
Which is a terrible idea on dry pavement, let alone ice. He slammed into the back of a parked car. He didn't see it at all.
Oh, no.
He hit it so hard, he flew over the handlebars,
yeah,
cleared the entire car roof, and landed on his feet on the other side.
You're kidding me. That is straight out of a cartoon. That is Looney Tunes logic.
He was completely unharmed.
Yeah.
The bike was a mess. The front wheel was basically a taco, but he walked away.
Wow.
There's such a common occurrence to wipe out that Mitch Butler mentions a custom they had. The ice cream rule.
What's the ice cream rule?
If your companion wiped out on the ice, they owed you an ice cream cone.
That's amazing.
Specifically, Laka flavor, which is cloudberry. It was a way to find humor in the constant bruising.
I love how they found a way to gamify the pain. Oh, you just bruised your hip. Great, you owe me a cloudberry cone.
Yeah, pretty much.
But it wasn't just the ice on the ground. It was what was happening in the sky. The sources talk about the northern lights with almost a spiritual reverence.
It provides this stark contrast.
Yeah.
You have the brutal, painful cold, and then you look up and you see magic.
Yeah.
Burke Rees describes a night in February 1973 where the sky just exploded. He said it looked like a giant movie screen. The colors were rushing toward the center of the sky and streaking upward.
That must have been breathtaking.
It was so intense that the locals were talking about it for days. For the missionaries, these moments seemed to validate why they were there.
Mm.
It was a moment of transcendence that made the frozen fingers and the oatmeal breakfasts worth it.
So you have the environment, which is actively trying to freeze you. Now let's talk about the actual work. Tracting, knocking on doors. This is the bread and butter of missionary work. But how does it actually work in that setting?
It was a grind. We are talking 9:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m., sometimes 10:00 p.m. Just walking up to houses or omakotes and apartment buildings or tallows. And the rejection was constant. Gary Walquist calls it the 1812 overture of door slams. Just boom, boom, boom.
And I imagine people aren't thrilled to be disturbed, especially shift workers.
Exactly. You're waking people up who work night shifts. They're angry. But the missionaries had to cope psychologically.
How did they do that?
President Wade told them, look, even if Jesus were here knocking on doors with you, people would still slam the door on him. It was a way to detach their personal worth from the rejection.
Right. It's not about you.
They weren't rejecting them. They were rejecting the interruption.
But sometimes the rejection wasn't just a slam door. Sometimes it had teeth.
The dogs. Oh, the dogs. Mm-hmm. This is a recurring theme in almost every memoir. The German shepherds.
They seem traumatized by them.
You really do. There was a story called Entering the Lion's Den by Gary Walquist. He and his companion went to a house with a picket fence.
Yeah.
There was a German shepherd going absolutely berserk.
Mm-hmm.
Barking, snarling. But the owner invited them in.
Mm. Come on in, he's friendly.
The classic line. They go into the backyard, and the dog is fine as long as they're sitting still at the picnic table. It's a standoff. But the second they stood up to leave, the dog switched back to attack mode.
Oh, geez.
The owner had to physically restrain the animal arms around its neck while the missionary sprinted for the gate.
Did they make it?
Barely. Walquist says the dog broke free just as they latched the gate. It hit the fence, trying to rip them to shreds. It's terrifying.
Yeah, that's nightmare fuel. And Scott Perkins has a story about using a briefcase as a shield.
Yes. He saw his companion, who had already been bitten and had stitches from a previous encounter, just turn and run when a dog appeared.
I don't blame him.
Perkins froze and held up his briefcase like a gladiator shield until the owner called the dog off. It adds this layer of physical danger to the daily routine that I think people forget about.
Right.
You aren't just worried about spiritual rejection. You're worried about getting mauled.
So with all this rejection and danger, the strategy had to change. They couldn't just keep trying to sell books, right?
This is an interesting pivot in their methodology. Originally, the goal was to place 25 books of Mormon a week. It was very sales-oriented.
Uh-huh.
But they weren't getting return appointments. People would take the book to get them off the porch, but then never invite them back.
Okay.
So they shifted to a family home evening approach.
What does that mean?
Instead of saying, read this book, they would say, let us come in and do a family lesson on values or togetherness. It was a service-oriented approach.
Ah, I see.
Burke Rees and his companion took it a step further. They stopped asking for return appointments and just started doing the lesson right there at the door.
A doorstep seminar.
Basically. And it worked. They went from zero return appointments to holding 30 family home evenings in a month.
Wow.
It was about offering immediate value rather than a product.
But even the best strategies can go wrong. I have to hear about the golden contact. This story sounds like a tragic comedy.
Oh, poor Mitch Butler. This is a painful one. They found a wealthy family, which was rare for them to get access to, who was actually interested.
Okay.
They had a perfect evening, great connection. The kids were engaged. It was a golden opportunity. They're walking on air.
Thinking, this is it, we did it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They leave the house, wave goodbye to the family who was watching from the large picture window.
Oh, I see where this is going.
And immediately hit a patch of ice on the steep driveway.
Oh, no.
They both slide, lose control, shoot across the road, and tumble into a ditch.
In front of the family?
In full view. They had to crawl out of the ditch covered in snow, wave and yell, we're okay.
Oh, the cringe.
Butler says they never saw the family again. The embarrassment was just too high. They couldn't go back.
That is painful. But it highlights how precarious their dignity was at any given moment. You can be a spiritual teacher one second and a slapstick comedy routine the next.
It does.
Mm.
But I want to zoom out a bit. We've talked about the dogs and the ice. But we need to talk about the Finns themselves. Because the Finland of the early 70s was a very specific place in history.
Right. We are only about 30 years past World War II.
Correct. And for Finland, that meant the Winter War against the Soviet Union. The scars were not metaphorical. They were physical and visible.
Mm.
Gary Walquist talks about the mumus.
Mumus.
That's what they call the war widows. He describes seeing them everywhere. Older women in black coats pushing sleds.
Boy sleds.
They used the sleds for balance on the ice and to carry groceries because there were no husbands to help them. An entire generation of men was missing or damaged.
And the men who were there, they were veterans.
Men over 50 were almost all veterans. Walkus tells a story about his landlord, his aizante. This man had spent 6 months in a Russian prisoner of war camp.
Oh, wow.
His daily ration was 300 grams of soggy bread. He dropped from 156 pounds to 99 pounds.
My God, 99 pounds?
Yeah. He told the missionaries that he made a pact with a friend in that camp. If they survived, they would never go hungry again. It explains the hardiness, the stoicism. It explains why they ate heavy food and wasted nothing. And then you have the landlady, the Imente, who recalled spending 16 hours in a dark, stagnant bomb shelter in Helsinki during a raid.
It really changes the context of the door knocking, doesn't it?
It does.
These young American kids who have never really known hardship are trying to teach resilience to people who survived the Winter War.
It's a profound disconnect. Walquist mentions watching a clip of the movie The Unknown Soldier, Tuntumatan Sotilas, which is the Finnish war movie.
Mm-hmm.
Watching the soldiers fighting in the forest at minus 40 degrees gave the missionaries a new respect for what these people had endured.
They must have.
It made their own complaints about the cold seem pretty trivial. Oh, my toes are cold. Well, this guy lost his foot to frostbite while fighting a tank.
Yeah.
It puts things in perspective.
And geographically, the threat wasn't gone. They were right next to the Soviet border.
Earl Price actually presented to a communist Finnish society. The Russian influence was right there. It wasn't history. It was geopolitics. The shadow of the East was always present.
So you have this massive cultural and historical gap, and on top of that, you have the language barrier. Finnish is not an easy language.
It is notoriously difficult. It's not Germanic. It's not Romance. It's Finno-Ugric.
Right.
Mark Meadows jokes about struggling to find the beginning and end of words. It's agglutinative. They just keep adding endings to words until they are a mile long.
And the mistakes they must have made.
Oh, the mistakes the missionaries made were legendary.
Carrie Carter's story is the classic here.
It is. He was talking to a widow at her door. He wanted to say, "Oh, you are the widow then," which would be Lesky.
Okay.
Instead, he said, "Oh, you are Lesky then."
Which means fat.
Oh, no.
Oh, you are fat then.
To a widow. That is mortifying.
To a widow. Yeah. But here's the beauty of it. She laughed. She burst out laughing.
It broke the ice in a way that perfect grammar never could. She ended up listening to them because they were human and vulnerable. They weren't these perfect robotic creatures. They were goofy kids who made mistakes.
Wow.
Carter notes that she was eventually baptized.
It's that human connection again. Sometimes being imperfect is the best way to connect.
Totally.
It seems like music played a big role in bridging that gap, too.
Yes. When words failed, they sang. Byron Taylor recalls learning Finnish Christmas songs, like Jilapuki, Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
They would go into hospitals and retirement homes and just sing. Even if they didn't understand every nuance of the lyrics, the act of singing Finnish songs to Finnish people showed a respect for the culture that resonated.
It showed they were trying.
Exactly.
We've talked about the missionaries, but we need to talk about leadership. A mission president sets the tone for the whole experience, and President Wade seems to be a larger-than-life figure in these memoirs.
He really is the architect of their success. When Bruce Golgi arrived, the mission was down to about 60 missionaries. Wade rebuilt it to over 100.
Wow.
But it wasn't just numbers. It was his philosophy.
The Ben Franklin method.
Right. Earl Price describes this. Wade loved Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. Franklin had a system where he focused on one virtue-like silence, order, or resolution for a set period to master it.
Okay.
Wade had the missionaries do this. Today is Honesty Day, or today is Industry Day. It gave him a framework for self-improvement that went beyond just religious rules. It was about character building.
And he also encouraged them to get creative. We mentioned Earl Price earlier. He started a PR campaign.
This is fascinating.
Yeah.
Price decided, with Wade's permission, to stop just knocking on doors.
Okay, so what did he do?
He went to City Hall, got a list of organizations, Rotary clubs, schools, reading groups, and just asked if they could come present.
Present on what?
Anything. Mormonism, life in America, English language, cowboy culture. And it worked. They got into the Rotary Club.
That's incredible.
And the feedback was amazing. The Rotary president stood up and thanked the church, not for the preaching, but for the genealogy work. The church had microfilmed Finnish records, preserving their history.
That's a powerful connection. It shows that value can be delivered in so many different ways.
Exactly. And for the missionaries themselves, these experiences created a spiritual metamorphosis, as Morgan Hendricks calls it.
Mm.
He talks about a promise President Wade made him, that his service would bring miracles to his family back home. Hendricks says he saw that fulfilled. But more than that, he talks about falling in love with the country.
It's the classic hero's journey. They go into the unknown, they face trials, the cold, the dogs, the language, and they come back changed.
Hendricks has a beautiful line about how he left his youthful memorabilia behind and replaced it with a deep, lasting love for Finland.
Mm.
It wasn't just a trip, it was an identity shift. They went as Americans, but they left with a piece of Finland in them.
So as we wrap this up, let's go back to where we started, the Book of Mormon holsters. To me, that is the perfect symbol for this entire experience.
I agree. Think about it. It's practical, it keeps you warm, and helps you do your job.
Right.
It's weird. It's a plastic harness made by who knows who, and it's misunderstood. The locals think you're a spy.
It encapsulates the whole thing. You are trying to do something spiritual, but you are dealing with the gritty, freezing reality of the physical world, all while being a total stranger in a strange land.
Yeah, and you just have to keep moving forward sideways to the wind.
Sideways to the wind. I love that. And I think that's the takeaway for our listeners. These men talk about sisu, the Finnish concept of grit or guts.
Sisu is the word. It's determination in the face of adversity. The Finns had it from the war.
Mm-hmm.
The missionaries had to learn it to survive the winter. It's about not giving up, even when the odds are stacked against you.
So whatever your version of the frozen breath or the German Shepherd is this week, find your sisu.
And maybe watch out for the ice on the driveway.
Definitely watch out for the ice. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the memories and miracles of Finland. We'll catch you next time.